On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Some say it began in Neil Doctorow's novel Ragtime, where he mentions the group of kids that became the Little Rascals. Some say it was the natural reaction to kids being not judged in the same way adults were when it came to race. These are all things that play a part in Julia Lee's terrific book, Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. She's sitting right across from me. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Elvis. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good.
But the fact is that this was such an interesting time because in terms of racial reaction to children, America was in such flux, wasn't it?
Right. I mean, this was a period where you had the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. You had increased racial violence, a series of race riots called Red Summer. And yet, at the same time that you have all of this friction among black and white communities, you have these little kids on screen getting along as if there is no such thing as race at all.
And also still what D.W. Griffith called, you know, his terrible mistake, Birth of a Nation, which is still informing the way adults were depicted in film at the time, weren't they?
Absolutely. Birth of a Nation had a revival around the time Our Gang first began. This was in the 20s.
And a pretty big revival at that
yes,
point.
Yes, and the Ku Klux Klan, I mean, it helped renew interest in the Klan and the Klan, you know, pageantry and costumes. And so, yes, Griffith's Birth of a Nation was very much on everyone's mind.
Let's talk a little bit about how the group got started as an entity.
The group got started because Hal Roach, I mean, this is the mythology behind the series, Hal Roach, who was this comedy producer with
responsible for Laurel and Hardy, among
yes,
other things.
Yes, Laurel and Hardy were his famous, and he also worked with Harold Lloyd and was this comedy producer who had created this studio where he built this studio in Culver City. And this was in the early 20s, and he claimed that he was just sick of these artificial trained SEAL child actresses and actors who would come to his studio and perform for him. And so one day he looked out of the window of his studio and saw a bunch of kids just playing around in the dirt in a lumberyard across the street. And he found them so interesting and cute that 10 minutes had passed and he thought, wow, if I can just turn this into a series, I could make a ton of money off of this. So that was sort of the idea of the beginnings of Our Gang. And the reality of it was that he already had a young black star at his studio named Sunshine Sammy Morrison, who was a star. I mean, was the first black actor, in fact, signed to a long-term contract in Hollywood at the age of 8 years old. And so Harold Roach thought, wow, you know, I'll take Sunshine Sammy Morrison, have him be the nucleus for this group. And then he cast children who just played around on the lot anyhow. There was Mary Kornman, who was the daughter of one of his cameramen. And then he cast, you know, Mickey and...
And the thing, too, also about Hal Roach is he really had a comedy factory. And I just found it so fascinating reading the book. I mean, you think about the theatricality of the comedy he was doing between Laurel and Hardy and Harold Lloyd, which were basically all set pieces that were married to the most gossamer plots, which is not to say that the Little Rascals things were heavily plotted either, right. But these things weren't presentational in that way. They weren't these little gems that were offered up for an audience delectation, but in fact, about behavior.
Yeah, yeah. And the early short films were not plotted in the way that we think today of, you know, a screenplay or a script where the kids were told, you know, you have to be here at this particular time and you have to do this activity. It was very important to both Hal Roach and to Bob McGowan, who was their first director, that they capture and they retain the natural quality of children's behavior, that they wouldn't be forced to act in ways that were not natural to them because that would ruin the charm of the series.
It's a treat when we're talking about race in the movies, but more specifically about The Little Rascals. The terrific book is Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. My guess is author Julia Lee. I guess I want to find out for you what made you decide to do this book.
I grew up watching The Little Rascals on television, and I grew up not far from Hal Roach Studios in Palms, you know, West Los Angeles. And it's funny to think, as I was growing up, you know, I just thought that the kids were funny and, you know, my parents worked. And so every afternoon I would just watch TV from the minute I got home and on the weekends. And at that time, not realizing that the films had been created, you know, decades earlier, nearly a century earlier, and that it had been unusual to see black and white children playing together on screen. I mean, this was something that never crossed my mind until I was older and I started studying race and studying especially the history of the black community in Los Angeles and realizing that this was in fact incredibly anomalous, unusual, and made me wonder, how was it able to be so popular? How did it maintain its popularity into the 70s and 80s when I was watching it on television? By that point, it had been syndicated to television starting in the 50s. And yet these were films that were first filmed in 1922. I mean, that's mind-boggling. I also grew up in L.A. during the 90s, where we had a period of racial uprisings with the Los Angeles riots. And to think that, you know, I'm growing up, I'm like 14, 15 years old when the riots occurred. And to think that here and even today that we still have these periods of strained race relations, and to think we haven't really come that far, and yet this series from the early part of the 20th century still carries this utopian ideal of what our country could be, and it's this ideal that we still haven't been able to attain. And I think that's something that puzzled me and really interested me about the series.
One of the things I find just so interesting about it, too, is this kind of thing that could never have happened inside of a studio.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to happen with somebody who's, in effect, an independent supplier of film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, when the series was eventually, Hal Roach eventually sold the series to MGM, and that was a period in which the quality of the series, people widely agree, fell off. And it was because it suddenly entered this factory studio system, and the MGM execs had their finger in every step of the process. And, you know, the MGM lot was not particularly democratic. If anything, it was incredibly hierarchical, right? I mean, you know.
What a politic way to put it.
Yes. You know, and I talk about it in the book.
The book,
that,
yes.
You know, it was like a monarchy over there, whereas Hal Roach Studios was slapstick democracy on set. I mean, yes, Hal Roach was the head of the studio, but the joke was that he'd worked in every single job working his way up in the studio, so he knew how to talk to the carpenter and the truck driver, just as he knew how to talk to an executive or to a director. And he was great with kids, and the children went to school on the studio lot, and it was not a segregated school, absolutely not. The kids all learned together, played together, and also ate together at the commissary. MGM was completely different. There was this interesting story about how the MGM executives were upset about one scene where Buckwheat was sitting next to Darla, and they came in, they rushed to the director at that time and said, you have to reshoot this scene because you cannot have the black boy sitting next to a white girl. And the director at that point was horrified and just said, forget it, and just cut the scene entirely because he didn't want to tell Billy Thomas, who played Buckwheat, that he'd have to sit in a different spot because it upset the MGM censors.
Well, see, that to me is the real heartbreak of the book, because it's the classic case of these people not realizing what the real asset was in this, the fact that there was this peculiar and particular democratization in these films that, mm-hmm. that may have been the way kids wanted to play together. And, mm-hmm. and actually the way if you go back to the New York of the late 1800s, there was that kind of race mixing. I mean,
right.
In lots of parts of the country that did exist.
Right. And that is something that brings up the nostalgic aspect to the series, is that, you know, children do, you know, the innocence of kids. They're naive. They don't recognize these social codes of behavior that adults place upon them. And so it's really only as children become older that they realize, oh, there's a racial hierarchy. Oh, you know, mom and dad don't think I should play with so-and-so because he or she is a different color. This is something that starts infecting children's worldviews at a very young age, but there's a sweet spot or this moment of innocence or this period of innocence where they get along great and they don't think about skin color or class or socioeconomic status, and that for a while adults generally think, okay, it's fine at this young age. They're so young. It's only as they get older that they need to be socialized. So there's this fantasy of if kids were in charge, things would be so much better. It's the adults that are the problem. And it's really in some ways still true. Adults are kind of the problem. And so there's something to be learned as well from the idealistic behavior of these little kids.
Don't look at me. Because what you get at is a lot of the enormous sophistication of some of these shorts. I mean, I was just really struck in reading that because I guess just reminded me of, again, how well worked out this was. I mean, it wasn't just slapstick, but just I was even thinking about the camera placement in it. I mean, because these things weren't staged where the cameras were like above the kids. I mean, the camera's always at eye level with the kids, so it gives them a kind of primacy that we're not used to seeing anybody of color during that period have.
Yeah. Yeah, and it becomes really subversive, really, because it's putting you in the eyes of these kids. It's putting into the position of, you know, children of all people are the most disempowered. I mean, I remember hearing how, in some ways, this is why children, you know, gravitate towards these stories of, you know, the kids outsmarting the adults, or, you know, these stories of, like, these animal folk tales about, you know, like the trickster rabbit or whatever, outsmarting the strong lion or something like that. I mean, there's something really gratifying for children who generally don't have much power in the world to show that they know more and can outwit adults who fancy that they know everything. And in fact, adults may not know everything at all.
Probably a good point to take a break. I'm the one who doesn't know much. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is Treat. My guest is Julia Lee. Her great book is Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back. I'm still not quite an adult. It's the treatment. I'm sitting across from my old friend, Julia Lee. Her great book is Our Gang, A Racial History of the Little Rascals. And I guess as we were talking, one of the things I was thinking about in these shorts, too, is also there's this other ongoing tragedy just about the kids aging out of the group and how the enormous impact it had on the children of color.
Yes. I mean, that was one of the really poignant parts of doing the research in this with this book, which is that child stars in general have a very, very short stage life or short careers because they're children and they will very soon outgrow their roles. The minute you get close to adolescence, you're no longer considered cute. You're no longer considered endearing. And so if an adult star could age out quickly, it's even exponentially faster for an actual child. The particular tragedy for black child stars is that, especially for young black boys, the stakes were even higher. A young black child was considered, you know, cute and, you know, comic and endearing, but a young black adult was considered something else entirely. Suddenly you have the threat of miscegenation, you have, you know, black masculinity, this fear, further fear of interracial relationships, all of this. And so a young black boy knew that the minute that he came upon adolescence, it was over. His career was over. With the young black children in our gang, this was compounded by the fact that you could see then young black stars, like younger children, being auditioned on the show. And you knew in the back of your head that, oh, so-and-so is coming in playing my little brother or little sister, but probably going to replace me at some point. Stymie Beard, who is one of the stars of the show, young
rock
stars.
One of the biggest stars.
Yes, he had the bowler hat, the famous bowler hat, which was a gift from Stan Laurel, who was his comedy idol and very good friend of his on set.
And who loved him, by the way.
Loved him, adored him. They were very good friends. But Stymie talked about how, you know, he started to get taller. He started to realize, oh, they're letting my hair grow out. Because every morning he went to the studio barber and got his head shaved for that day's shooting. And then suddenly they were letting his hair grow. And he realized, oh, they're sort of easing me out. They're not paying attention to me at all. And he said that he could hear the footsteps coming and he didn't want to go. And he started to realize this is what Farina, who he replaced, must have felt when Stymie suddenly appeared on the set and started to get more lines. That was how Stymie started to feel when suddenly Buckwheat, Billy Thomas, appeared on set and started to have more lines.
And also the real sad aspect of this, too, was that as they aged out, there's no place else for them to go.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of them had very difficult post-Our Gang lives. Some of them did. I mean, any child star, it's very difficult even today to navigate the transition to adulthood.
And it was difficult particularly. There are a number of tragedies to be found in the story of the Little Rascals anyway.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, they talk about the Little Rascals curse, the curse of the child star. You know, Alfalfa died young and was shot to death. And, you know, you think of so many of these examples. But the young black stars all had difficult post-Our Gang roads as well because there wasn't much in the way of a career for them as they entered adolescence. And then there was also the difficult transition of going back to the neighborhood and, you know, you're no longer on the studio lot. It had an integrated school. You are now going to your local public school where kids are making fun of you for the fact that you were this fancy actor. You can't get much work and you have to start thinking about, well, what else can I do with my future? Somebody like Stymie Beard had a particularly tragic afterlife or post-gang life. He talked about experimenting with marijuana and then with harder drugs. He ended up being jailed for petty theft and eventually ended up spending time in prison. He became addicted to heroin and was also, you know, was caught selling heroin and ended up spending, I believe it was 6 years in prison. Finally got out, got clean, and managed to resurrect his career in the 70s by appearing in small parts on television shows. He appeared on Sanford and Sons, Good Times, and had a small career revival, but then died prematurely. I think he was 50 years old.
I guess the thing we should talk about a little bit here, too, is how long the life of the Little Rascals conceptually was. I mean, it was something that started, as you mentioned, in the silent era and ran for a long period of time.
Right. It started in the silent era. It made the transition to the talkie era, you know, pretty smoothly, all things considered. I mean, certainly there were some actors that Hal Roach had in his stable that did not make the transition. But the kids, I mean, it was iffy for a while because these children, a lot of them didn't know how to read. And then suddenly it's the talkie era and they have to suddenly memorize lines. They'd never had to do that before. They'd never had to learn that they, you know, they had these complicated cameras that were in these big sound booths and they had to remain silent when other kids were talking and they weren't used to that. And so and they were also used to calling each other by their real names, not their stage names. So sometimes a take was ruined because, you know, Farina's nickname was Sonny. And so the kids would call him Sonny as the cameras were rolling and they'd have to refilm that scene. So it was a headache for Roach, but eventually, you know, the talkies became quite popular. Then in the mid-30s, Hal Roach was losing money on these comedy shorts and he ended up selling the entire series to MGM. MGM essentially ran the series into the ground. They became very stilted. Some of the kids stayed on far too long. I mean, they looked like they were teenagers and they were still appearing on The Little Rascals. And then in the early 40s, the series was finally canned. This was during the war and MGM finally pulled the plug because they were not profitable. It was then in the mid-50s, 1955, that Our Gang was syndicated to television under the name The Little Rascals. And it was an immediate hit, even though people thought, God, these are old now. Do people really want to see these anymore? But in fact, children did want to watch these shows, and their parents loved watching the shows too because for them it was a nostalgic factor. They thought of growing up, going to the theaters and watching these shorts, and they wanted to watch them again, remind themselves of their own childhoods. series was still popular through the 70s, although there was some pushback with some of the racial stereotyping in the series. Parts were censored. It was repackaged with some of the worst offending shorts taken out. And that was the version that I watched growing up in the late 70s into the 80s.
But what's interesting, too, as you mentioned in the book, is that even after they were canceled and MGM basically spat on its luster, there was still this enormous amount of affection for those. I mean, people had – and this is a time before television in the mid to late 40s, and people talked about them and still loved them.
Yeah. I think there's a great deal of identification that goes along with it. You think of yourself as growing up with these kids. You think of them as your own friends. And so there's always this curiosity about what happened to them as they got older. There's always been this interest in, oh, so where are they now? You know, that sort of question of, oh, you know, did they grow up and become successful actors, you know, or are they now doing something else entirely? So there were often reunions, like TV Guide had a reunion for the early cast of Our Gang in the 50s, you know, bringing them back when they're in their 20s and 30s, and some of them have left entertainment entirely.
Yeah, that was a pretty sordid tale.
Yes, and it still happens. I mean, you think about there was a Little Rascals remake. I'm not sure. Did you have to watch it?
I did have to watch it.
It was in 1994.
No, be serious.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I was looking in, I was on people.com the other day, or this was like a year ago maybe, and they had a 20th anniversary, because that was came out in 94, and 20 years have passed. So in 2014, they brought the cast of that Little Rascals together and photographed them, because the kids who were watching that in 1994 were now grown-ups and kind of wanted to know where these kids that they remembered fondly, how they had turned out.
My guest who's willing to brave the wiles of people.com is Julia Lee. Her book is out. Okay. A Racial History of the Little Rascals. It's a great book. There's a section I earmarked. I just asked you if you wouldn't mind reading it for us. You can set it up for us.
This is a section that is about Sonny Hoskins. Sonny played the first breakout star of Our Gang, a character named Farina. And he started on the show when he was a year and a half old. He could barely walk. He could barely talk. But he was a natural. He could cry on demand. He was really easy to work with, except for when he had tantrums, but he eventually outgrew those. And he really became probably the most famous star of Our Gang, especially in the 20s. I mean, President Coolidge said he was his favorite star. He was what you would call a superstar today.
He's also the same Coolidge who liked Birth of a Nation, but that's another
right,
conversation.
Right, I know, which is one of the ironies of this. Yeah. In any case, so this is describes about Sonny and his interactions with Sunshine Sammy Morrison, who played his big brother on the series.
So I want you that because of that intersection, that overlap.
Yeah,
between
yeah.
The two
of them, I mean, they were the oldest and the youngest members of the original gang. They played brothers. And Sunshine Sammy at this point is like 8 or 9 years old. He's a seasoned veteran. Meanwhile, Farina is a year and a half and is a very temperamental toddler. So in any case, so Sonny, and this is Sonny Hoskins, who played Farina, started appearing in Our Gang soon after, and this was a picture that I showed, it was taken. He was the youngest member of the original gang and reportedly learned to walk and talk on the set. He could be cantankerous and temperamental, a typical toddler, in other words. Too young to understand the sight gags, too small to keep up with the older kids, he made up for his age and size with his enormous personality. Sonny got along well with Ernie Morrison. Ernie was Sunshine Sammy. Ernie, at age 10, though, was much older and already a seasoned professional. Ernie got things done on the first take. He did not need to be bribed with donuts or entertained by Harold Lloyd. He was the veteran of the gang, Sonny the novice. Together, they were the oldest and the youngest members of the original gang and the only black children. If the kids in the gang were renowned for being real and natural, Sonny was the realest and most natural of them all. He was so young that he wasn't acting most of the time. When a mule chased him around the set, he really was scared. When a gag prop exploded in his face, he really was surprised. Miguel recalled that on one of Sonny's first days on the lot, a worker played a seemingly innocuous prank on the little boy. Watching the kids prepare a scene, the worker stepped over, moved a bearskin rug towards Sonny, and cried, "Boo!" Sonny was hysterical, and it took quite some time for him to calm down. Director McGowan banned the playing of pranks on any of the kids in the gang from then on. Still, Sonny was always on guard. He had to know what everything was before he would do anything, McGowan remembered, and he would never stir a step if there were visitors on the set. During a shoot in Venice Beach, a nearby resort community, Sonny was led to a spot on the set where a gust of air could be blasted from below. He was immediately suspicious. "Mr. Gowan, are you going to blow my pants off?" he asked. Another time, he spied a custard pie. Instead of getting hungry, he got worried. "Mr. Gowan, are you going to hit me in the face with that pie?" McGowan was forced to start telling the truth. "Sonny, we're going to play train," he would say. "Now Mickey is going to be the engineer, Fatty Cobb the fireman, Jackie Condon the conductor, and you're going to be the Pullman porter. Now I want you to go by the engine where they're going to squirt flour in your face. It'll look like steam, and it won't hurt." Sonny balked. "It won't hurt?" He'd heard that before. In the end, the only thing that convinced Sonny to cooperate was when he heard the rest of the gang was playing along. Now goats were another sore point. Sonny hated the animals. Once, when he was told he'd be sharing a scene with a baby goat, Sonny put his foot down. Nothing would make him budge. Not the promise of a new dress suit, tasty treats, or even an upcoming scene with Pretty Dorothy, Ernie's sister. "Dey dead by dote," he explained, which translates to, "I bit by goat" in toddler speak. It wasn't just Sonny who needed to be prodded into performing gags. All the kids had moments of stubbornness or just plain fear. The gang was filming an airplane scene once, and a plane had been attached to a block and tackle. It was to be hoisted 40 feet into the air. McGowan noticed Joe Cobb had turned pale. "If you're scared, you don't have to do it," McGowan gently told him. Joe, along with Jackie Condon, was one of the most sensitive members of the gang. If McGowan raised his voice or scolded him, Joe was liable to burst into tears. "Gee, I'm scared, Mr. McGowan," Joe admitted. "But I'll do it if you want me to." And he did. 6-year-old Joe Cobb climbed into the airplane, was hoisted into the sky, and filmed his scene.
That terrific vignette we just heard is from Julia Lee's great book, Our Gang, A Racial History of Little Rascals. And it does so much. You offer us a history of the group. You let us know how difficult it could be to work with kids. You also make it very clear about the enormous innate talents that they had and how they were used and how they were becoming savvy on the set. I mean, it's in constructing scenes like that, how much fun was that to do?
It was so much fun. And in fact, probably the most fun part of writing this book is just reading about these hilarious stories where, you know, working with kids, I mean, they called the director, Bob McGowan, Job, because his job was so miserable and difficult, and he had to wrangle all these kids. And, you know, I mean, he had several nervous breakdowns, and they say it's from having to deal with these kids. And he was adored by the children. They loved him. But to constantly have to do take after take because somebody's cranky and somebody needs to go to the bathroom and somebody just is in a bad mood, I mean, there's one great scene where he was begging Harold Lloyd to help him keep his kids in line. And Harold Lloyd yells at him, "I have my own movie to shoot. What are you talking about?" And they're dangling donuts in front of the kids and trying to get them to play along. And sometimes it was just, you know, it was impossible. And one time Farina refused to turn up a switch. And they spent take after take after take. And Farina threw a tantrum and said, "No, I refuse to." And so they closed the set. They said, "Forget it. Okay, we're done for the day." And as soon as everybody packed up, Farina walked over to the switch and turned it on. And McGowan just said, "God, can you believe it? Like, this is every day of my life."
Well, after your interest, because of just the social phenomenon of the Little Rascals, mm-hmm. clearly one of the things that appealed to you is just there are so many narratives that thread their way through this thing.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, really the overarching story and the person who frames the story is Farina Hoskins, who was the first real breakout star, primarily because he did end up defying, you know, the tragedy of many of his fellow child stars. He always said, "I don't get bogged down in the past. I'm always looking towards the future." And for him, he refused to let Our Gang define him.
It's a great book. The book is Our Gang, A Racial History of Little Rascals. Its author is sitting right across from me. She's my old friend, Julia Lee. Thank you so much
for doing this. Thank
you, Elvis. Oh, completely. My pleasure. It's such a fun book. Our recording engineer here in Las Vegas at KNPR is Casey Morrell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Wright, who's associate producer. I'm not part of anybody's gang. It's The Treatment.
Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.